This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Good evening, this is Michelle Manning Scott, and before we begin the program this evening, Bob and I want to thank all of you for your support during our fall membership drive last week. Your contributions and kind comments let us know how much you appreciate the work Bob and I do each week to bring you Civil Rights and Wrongs. Informing, engaging, and enriching this community is at the heart of our mission for this program. But Bob and I are not alone. Every programmer here at Co-op Radio is a committed volunteer that brings their own unique passions and creativity to the programs they create. Whether the program is produced live in our studios or crafted from home, we do this so we can keep on entertaining and informing all of you, our dedicated co-op listeners. And there's still time if you didn't get a chance to donate last week. Just go to koop.org now and let us know you appreciate the station and want us to co-op on, y'all. Thank you again for all of your support.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on September 21st, 2021. Statistically speaking, the United States leads the world in incarceration rates, with the prison population hovering at over 2 million currently in 2021. And Texas currently holds the disgraceful distinction of being the state with the largest number of people incarcerated, the most recent numbers stating it at about 155,000 statewide. According to data published by the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit The Sentencing Project, incarceration in the United States has increased by 500% over the past 40 years. Given these numbers, it's no wonder there has been an increased outcry for criminal justice reform over the past decade. In an opinion piece published by The Hill back in January, the two authors put forth multiple arguments for evidence-based paths toward these needed reforms. Evidence-based reform draws on lessons learned from medicine and other disciplines and advocates policies driven by the results of research, rather than anecdote or collective assumptions. The authors go on to suggest an agenda for these research and evidence-based reforms focused in three key areas: prosecutorial charging discretion, participatory defense efforts, and the needs of small, tribal, and rural, or STAR, communities. The power prosecutors have to determine the fates of defendants in legal cases is one of the least understood aspects of the judicial system, and the lack of training and oversight prosecutors receive leads to inequitable and often harmful outcomes for many defendants and their families. Meanwhile, both criminal prosecutors and public defenders are overburdened by caseloads, the results of over-policing of our communities. Lack of resources and funding mostly leaves public defenders with not enough time to gather the necessary information to prepare their clients' cases, which leads to defendants being encouraged to plead guilty rather than challenge the state's evidence, mainly as a method to keep the court system from becoming backlogged. The judicial systems in urban and suburban areas get the most national attention, but those within the STAR communities are too often ignored, leading to unchecked corruption and abuse in these legal deserts with few, if any, experienced criminal lawyers on either side of the aisle. The solutions proposed by these authors involve federal funding to support research-based efforts to improve accuracy, fairness, and timeliness of prosecutorial charging decisions, grants to support participatory defense efforts nationwide, and a federally funded program that would work with law schools and bar associations to incentivize law students and other legal practitioners to commit to working in STAR communities for certain periods of time. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at co-op.org. I'm Michelle Manning Scott, guest hosting the program this evening. Bob Daly will be on at the end of the hour this evening with his usual conversation with Austin Sanders from the Austin Chronicle. Our guest this evening is Anna Harris, founder and executive director of Just Us Participatory Defense, a nonprofit organization founded in Bastrop County that offers criminal defense assistance to indigent defendants from a reform-minded approach grounded in community participation. Welcome to the program, Ms. Harris.
Thank you again for inviting me to be on this show.
So let's start by having you tell us about your backstory up to this point of founding Just Us Participatory Defense, how you got to that point.
Sure. So I was like most Americans that ignorantly believed that the justice system was functioning and, you know, justice was being served. And again, ignorantly, I presumed that everyone in county jail was guilty of sin and all the uneducated things that go along with that. I worked for the state of Texas, specifically DFPS, for 11 years as an investigator in several different jobs. So literally, I was on the completely opposite side of the position I am now. And I guess halfway into my 11th year at the DFPS, my husband went to the lake one afternoon and had four beers, drove home. This was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. A car pulled out in front of him and he hit them and someone died because of the accident. We retained a lawyer for $25,000. And then we didn't bond him out and he stayed there. We couldn't get a hold of the attorney. He visited my husband maybe twice in 18 months and would only see him at docket. He was never provided the discovery. And so during this 18 months that he was in county jail, I was like, I have to learn all this and figure out what's going on because obviously we're not being represented by our retained attorney and he's not even giving us any information. So I immersed myself in case law and read codes and rules all day long. And then I started being the smartest person that anyone in the jail knew. And so people in his tank would be like, will you ask my court date? They didn't know when their next court date was. They didn't have the information of their appointed lawyer. And there was no one out here helping them. And eventually my information spread throughout the jail rather rapidly. And then I was off to the races and it was such a slap in the face and my heart was so broken that this system that I had worked for essentially and believed in for so long was a complete facade and actually the opposite of what it's intended to do. I remember I was sitting at my desk and I was like trying to research case law and I just was like, I'm quitting. And so I quit. My husband was, his attorney was able to coax him into taking a 15-year plea offer on intox manslaughter, which the max is 20. So that's not even really a good deal. I got his file 2 weeks after he pled, and I wasn't an attorney, and I certainly am not where I am now. I found a huge hole. He should have never been charged with intox manslaughter because alcohol was not the causing factor of the accident. The people that were at the stop sign took a right-hand turn onto a two-lane highway into the left-hand lane to beat a car in the right-hand lane. The law states that you have to turn the closest lane to you. You can't merge into the outside lane, merge into the inside lane. And there was a car in the inside lane. So they didn't even see my husband in the outside lane. And they pulled out into the furthest lane. And his BAC was 0.10, 2/10 over the legal limit. Everything came back. He had proper reactions. Alcohol was not the causing factor. The accident would have happened regardless. He was forced into an intox 15-year 3G plea, and he's still gone. But at that point, I couldn't do anything else but this.
Let's start by having you explain the concept of participatory defense. How is it different from the quote-unquote traditional defense model? And then, if you can, maybe talk about what you know about its creation and history.
So I didn't know what I was doing was called participatory defense either. I can tell you that I was so excited to find a label whenever I stumbled upon Raj and Debug in California.
So that's the national organization.
That's like the originating hub.
Okay, so it's called participatorydefense.org. I've been to the site and I've seen it, so yes.
Yeah, it's actually Debug is the original because that was not even there whenever we started. It was just Debug. And so I reached out to him immediately and I was like, Do you have a mentor program or a model or anything that you can give me? Because at that point, there was just one 14-minute TED Talk that he had that I stumbled upon. And he was like, no, we really don't have anything. So I bounced ideas back and forth to him and just started helping individuals as they called. It wasn't the same every time, but sometimes it was. And literally building the plane as I flew it. I've never been so broken my whole entire life, but I didn't care at that moment. So the traditional approach, you know, attorneys, God bless their souls, often they have just tunnel vision. You know, this is what I do. I don't do anything else. I use the state's witnesses. File a motion for discovery. You know, file that habeas to get the $100. And majority of the time prior to us intervening, defendants were not ever seeing the state's evidence against them before the attorney was coaxing them into signing a plea. And most of the time, rather quickly. And some attorneys were getting their clients to sign a waiver of non-disclosure for discovery. So there was a lot of issues. And I realized that people were getting convicted that were innocent. And we didn't even know what the state had. They weren't being required to show that burden of proof.
And so participatory defense is more along the lines of, from what I understand, use of family and community members to bring forth evidence as to the character of the defendants and basically using them as a way to get the evidence needed to defend the person in court. Is that kind of the basic idea?
So the national model does community organizing, where you have family members meet once a week and it's more peer-led. We attempted to do that rurally because rural is our complete focus. And what I presumed would happen did. You know, these small towns, everyone knows everyone. You know the cops know where you live. So people that were organizing with us and their children or grandkids were still on the streets and started to get busted and taken to jail. And retaliatory things started happening. So for big cities, it may work, but not in rural areas. So our model is more service-based than community organizing.
Okay. So you're more one-on-one with your defendants that are in court. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically like a mitigator. And a lot of the stuff that we do is not necessarily legal stuff. A lot of it is having medical issues that are not being properly handled in the jail or the local mental health authority, even though that's their client. They're not seeing their client or providing medication.
Right.
Finding appropriate pretrial diversion, or we also have MOUs with several rehab facilities that have beds for us. So we're able to give the state an alternative. Instead of just sending everyone to TDC, they have pretrial diversion potentially that's not out of the state's checkbook or the county's checkbook to rehab over incarceration. There's so much stuff that we do, it's so hard to explain. And every day it changes. We do a lot with parole as well. But yes, it is more one-on-one-ish. And legal work is not necessarily the only thing that we provide.
Got it. So you're advocates. You're basically advocates.
Advocate, educate, and support defendants and their families pretrial. And a big thing that we have, because rurally, there's one investigator for like a whole region and he's horrible, or the expert pool is non-existent. So that is a huge thing that we do provide, is a database of experts that we have their certification on file. They're willing to accept indigent defense expert witness funds, and they will travel and not start charging until they enter the county of the charge. So that's huge. Rurally, I can't really speak to what they do in larger areas, but the state's witnesses and the state's evidence is all they use. You rarely see a trial that they have employed their own experts, clinicians, and investigators. They always just use the state's because there's not an alternative. Yeah.
So how long has Just Us been an organization? And then we talked about the fact that you got started in Bastrop County. What other counties here in Texas do you work with? And do you actually personally travel to all these locations around the state? Or do you have a team in place at this point that kind of helps you out and goes to the different places to help the defendants in these areas?
We originated in Bastrop County, and that was almost 7 years ago. and then expanded to Caldwell, Lee, Fayette, probably about 2 years later, because Mono Amiga, who is another nonprofit out of Hays County, we merged and took on Caldwell together. Last November, we contracted with Texas Jail Project. We're actually in 8 counties, respectively, is our region, but we do, of course, take courtesy cases in several other counties that are direct referrals from Texas Jail Project. Texas Jail Project originated from a case that came out of Victoria County. So it's hard to find someone that's not an attorney but knows this stuff. We have an attorney that's not practicing in Bastrop, Lee, Fayette, Caldwell. And then I temporarily came to Victoria almost a year ago now.
So you're stationed in Victoria.
Yes, Victoria, Calhoun, Jackson, and DeWitt counties.
And that's in South Texas, correct?
I don't really consider it South Texas. I feel like this is South Central. South Texas to me is like Laredo, Cotulla.
Okay. It's a big state. If you're not familiar with all the different areas, you can get lost real easily. So that's why I'm trying to establish for people what you're talking about. Victoria County and Fayette County. People are like, where's that? People that live
right
in cities.
I call it the crossroads, but I don't really consider it any sort of vacation destination.
Right. It's a very rural area of Texas is what we're getting at here. So that's where your bases are, where you go to do the work that you do is in the rural areas. There's plenty of people that are concentrated in all the cities. And so, yes, the rural areas are what really need the help, which is part of what my opening remarks were referring to, is that these small counties are where people get forgotten. There's people that are not qualified to be there doing this kind of work, and therefore the defendants in those counties are often the ones that suffer the most because of the lack of true expertise.
Yeah, I call it the Wild West. Like my stories, people, they gasp. And I thought this was the norm. It's unbelievable. Their access to justice is zero. It's almost like a mob mentality because of the good old boy
network.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an appointment lottery list, but then there's this post-it with the 5 attorneys that really are the only ones that get appointed. And that's the issue, is these attorneys are afraid of being removed from the appointment list because that's their bread and butter. Some of them are getting 500 felonies a year and making $200,000 on indigent defense funds. It is very serious. Retaliation is very real.
So where are you getting funding for this right now? I mean, how do you keep going? Who's helping you?
Originally, we had a private funder that funded my salary. And then that continued until we started to get funding. We don't get government funding or Fed dollars. We prefer unrestricted funds to implement this. Because often when you get grant funding, they're like, we want this bullet point accomplished. But the work that we do is, you can't stay on an outline. Every case is different and throws you a new wrench daily. So those funders have definitely ramped up. Of course, since my article
appeared in the Post.
Yes, which is amazing because I have literally busted my tail to do this.
So why don't we talk about the Washington Post opinion piece that's gotten you a bit of notoriety here. Good notoriety.
Yeah.
So that happened where you are now, in Victoria, Texas, which is where you're stationed at the moment.
Yes, ma'am.
And you were interviewed by Radley Balco of the Washington Post about the experience you had. So why don't you start with the backstory about what happened, and then you can talk about what happened afterwards.
So we don't come in and announce ourselves. We just start showing up at the courthouse, becoming a familiar face, doing some court watch, just trying to understand this specific court's ways of trying to provide justice. In the rural courts, there's nobody in the courtroom except for lawyers and defendants and maybe a mom or whatever. So when they see a new face, it's automatically noticed. No one ever asked me what I did. I introduced myself to the indigent defense coordinator.
So they find out that you're there to assist defendants. And not as an attorney capacity, but the word spreads that you're there to help. That's
right.
What you're saying.
Yes.
So this is one of your first experiences in that particular courtroom in Victoria when this started.
No. So we started a year ago in November.
So you'd been there for a while when this started?
Yes, I had been there for a while. And the judge, he would always yell at me in court.
Even though you were allowed to be there.
Yeah, I could tell he was finding things to pick on me about, like very petty things and like making up random rules that he decided to have. But I mean, it's business. I wasn't upset about it. Like, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, put your laptop up. I had it out during recess. So it's like, you're not an attorney. Every time I was in there, he was like, are you an attorney? I was like, no, Your Honor. Well, then get out of here. Because they don't want people watching. They don't know what you do. They don't ask. You're new. And so you're scary. I went up to the district clerk's office probably about a month and a half after we had been here with a client's mother and asked to access the public access terminal to get some stuff for a potential appeal for her son. And the public access was behind a badged area. Because of the small town politics and that I'm not aware of, apparently one of the clerks and the mom had previous issues and it became a yelling match. And so the bailiffs came up there and escorted us out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so just to be clear, am I being trespassed from a public building? He was like, oh, no. All right. Well, the next day I called the district clerk. Hey, I'm sorry. You know, just trying to be amicable. And she told me that I am banned from the district clerk's office. And she told me I was never allowed in the district clerk's office because I had been escorted by police out. I was like, all right, whatever, that's fine. I didn't push it because if I needed to go up there, I would, but I haven't needed to since. Then probably for about 3 months, well, number one, my driver's license picture was printed out like a wanted poster posted behind the security desk. And I had to be followed by a bailiff everywhere I went in the courthouse. That lasted about 3 weeks. And then the bailiffs, they started not doing what they're supposed to do because I'm not doing anything. There was nothing to observe. They were just attempting to intimidate me because they didn't know what I did. And it seemed scary, which is often what happens. But I don't intimidate easily. So I just kept persevering and made friends with the bailiffs. And they realized that she's pretty harmless. So they called off what I called aggravated babysitting. And probably 2 months later, we were contracted with a lawyer. And we were actually mitigating, had a trial, because I'm a certified paralegal drafting for him too, during the trial. And I have severe ADHD. Like I have some tics. So one of my tics when I'm overly focused and stressed is that I will suck on my tongue. And I don't know I do this. And I certainly did it involuntary. But when I do it, it looks like I'm smiling. The judge pointed it out to me. During this jury trial, I'm hyper-focused. I had just had a busted eardrum. I was hearing it like 42%. So I was having to focus really intently on whoever was speaking to read their lip because I'm taking notes. And drafting and all kinds of stuff. And so during the voir dire, I was taking notes, demographics and all that jazz. And then I stood up to count. And one of the prospective jurors starts to say something to me. And I literally put my notebook up so I couldn't even read her lips. And the judge was like, what are you doing talking to jurors? And I was like, what? And me having ADHD didn't realize he was yelling at me because I was hyper-focused on counting. And he was like, sit down. I was like, oh, me? And so I sat down. And then we recessed and I had to run downstairs to pick up a copy. And the judge pulled the attorney up and said, she's over there talking to jurors. And I already told her not to. Then during recess, I called her out in the hallway talking to jurors. And so the attorney went outside and they had mistaken another juror for me. They're like, that's not her. And so I came back upstairs. I was like, oh, whatever. I don't know what his deal is. So I sat down and we picked a jury. And I guess it was day two during recess. The jury's not in yet. He yells at me to put my phone up. So I cannot come in his courtroom, even having my phone out, even if there's no court proceedings going on. Because as soon as I walk in the courtroom door and he sees my phone, he will yell at me to put my phone up or else he's going to have the bailiffs take it. That's just going to happen every time I walk in the courtroom. But I'm mitigating. So I'm texting the attorney often or looking up stuff. This time specifically, I was communicating with a potential witness that had showed up during trial, trying to feel her out or whatever. under the direction of the defense attorney. This is recess. I said, okay, no problem. And I put it up. And he said, no, you know what? Go on the record. Come up here. I was like, okay, no problem, Your Honor. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I am the expert mitigator and the paralegal for the defense. And he said, I've been getting reports from the jury and the bailiffs. You're making faces at the jury and intimidating the jury or whatever. Again, I'm mitigating and have ADHD and have tics and apparently was sucking on my tongue. And at this point, he had already accused me of talking to the jurors. So I did not ever even look at a juror from that point on because I know how he is. He's going to target me. So I made sure not to do that. I asked on the record, I said, do I get a rebuttal? And he was like, no, you don't get a rebuttal. And he said, if you do it again, this could cause us to have a mistrial. If you do it again, you're getting kicked out. And I was like, yes, Your Honor. I went back and sat down on the first row. So I have a plain view of any witnesses that get on the stand so I can read their lips. And he yells at me. He's like, you can't sit on the first row and you need to get on the other side away from the jury. At that point, I said, my hearing is 42% and severely diminished. I'm having to watch the lips of people testifying to do my job. And he said, go ahead, sit over there. You're just hurting your client's case. So I sat a bench back. The next day, I went to go to Starbucks and was chased down and pulled over. He came up to my window and I said, why am I being pulled over? He said, give me your driver's license and insurance, and then I'll tell you. And so I was pulling my insurance card up on my phone, and he grabbed my phone from me and slammed it on my hood and jerked me out of my car. And I cooperated, and then he told me that I was being arrested for failure to signal when change lanes and littering. Of course, all that stuff has miraculously disappeared now and didn't happen. But it was clearly retaliatory. We have witnesses that state that they saw him coming all the way across town really fast, trying to get to me. And his police report shows that he followed me from my house, which doesn't cooperate with the witnesses. Mm-hmm. And he was in the city when he is actually a sheriff's deputy. So it wasn't even in his jurisdiction.
We're speaking with Anna Harris, founder and executive director of Just Us Participatory Defense, a nonprofit organization working in several rural Texas counties that offers criminal defense assistance to indigent defendants from a reform-minded approach grounded in community participation. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning Scott. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on September 21st, 2021. We're speaking with Anna Harris, founder and executive director of Just Us Participatory Defense, a nonprofit organization working in several rural Texas counties that offers criminal defense assistance to indigent defendants from a reform-minded approach grounded in community participation. Let's continue. So then you were handcuffed and taken to jail, and they impounded your car, apparently.
Yes, They searched. They did an inventory, which was a search of my car, impounded my car. One of the things that really impacted me is that they left me in the back of that hot car in the Sallyport, not able to get anyone officer's attention behind me for probably 20 minutes. I really thought I was going to die. I couldn't catch my breath, and I was literally talking to the camera. If I'm fixing to die in this hot car, this is what happened, explained everything that happened in case I died. Then they took me upstairs, booked me. Then I stayed, I guess, in a holding thing. I don't know. They don't have clocks. So maybe like 4 hours. Then they just ejected me out of there. And I asked them, I said, all my friends are asleep. They have to work tomorrow. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Y'all impounded my car. How am I supposed to get home? They're like, you can stay here. I'm like, why would I choose that?
Yeah. So how'd you get home?
I walked. My phone was dead. The officer broke my phone when he slammed it on my hood. It was broken. So I didn't have keys to my house because my keys were in my car that was impounded and I couldn't get them. So I walked home at like 1 o'clock in the morning. It was a little bit of a feat the next day to get a hold of people because I didn't have a phone or transportation to talk to anyone or get anywhere and get my car. And then by the next morning, that didn't exist.
Yeah, the charges were dropped.
Yeah, whenever my attorneys called them the next morning, he didn't even know what they were.
So your attorney, the one that you worked with, he didn't even know what the charges were against you at that point? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no, Victoria County's attorney.
Oh,
whenever my attorneys called them the next morning, he said, you owe me a thank you because I already got the charges dropped. And one of my attorneys asked, well, do you know what the charges were? He said, no, it doesn't matter. I just made sure they got dropped. He was like, what?
Got it.
I wanted to make sure that I didn't give them any ammo. I was so cordial during my arrest time or in jail. Now I go in and out of the jail and they're like, hey, you know, don't lock this door. I joke with them all the time. It's very important to me to establish those relationships at the low level because they're not going to have anything to say negative about me, even if I'm getting retaliated against from the top down.
You haven't had any lasting repercussions from that experience, have you, that have come back later on? It's pretty much just
from getting arrested?
Yeah.
Well, no, but then they found out my criminal history, which was supposed to be super scandalous. A reporter just did a story about me last week, and he was like, so I don't know if I should bring this up, but, you know, one of the things that they're looking into is your criminal history. I was like, they can come to my office because my mugshot's framed big as day behind my desk. There is no secret. I always said, if I run for office, my mugshot will be my campaign photo. One of the things that I've heard the judge say or the county say is, we didn't realize who she was. I don't understand why that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Because that's the way these counties work. They aren't used to others watching and knowing what to watch for. And so it's sovereign immunity. That's how serious this is, that these judges are not being held accountable and the courts are not being held accountable because they think that that is something that you can do and that'll stick. Who else has he done this to? No telling.
Right. I'm going to pivot and just come back to Just Us, your organization. Mm-hmm. Do you have a plan in place? I guess my main question would be, are you planning to grow it beyond that? You said it was 8 counties at this point you're working in?
Yes. Actually, funny you asked that. I don't want to divulge too much secret information.
No.
I mean, yes, there's an expansion plan and a collaborative plan with other agencies that I've been waiting for another nonprofit to get their ducks in a row to implement together as a united force and just taking county by county and having a participatory defense, a public defender's office, and a Texas Joe project. Just clean it up one county at a time.
Got it. Well, it sounds good. Lastly, I want to give you a chance to give us your website or what's the best way for people who want to learn more or possibly help you get in contact with you. So you can tell us that.
Our website is www.justusparticipatorydefense.org. It's bare minimum because we don't advertise much because we need less clients. But there's an intake form on there. You can, of course, find us on Facebook, Just Us Participatory Defense. And we have two separate numbers. The South Texas phone number is 361-263-4973. And the Central Texas phone number is 512-629-2618. The best way is probably to send us a message on social media is pretty easy because we have people in place to refer those, but any method will work.
Okay, good.
I'm super excited where this has gone. I never expected this, but it's going to change the world. It really is.
Well, I hope so. That sounds great.
Yes.
I mean, the concept and the information that I read online on the participatorydefense.org website sounded quite revolutionary as a concept. So I hope it does take off. I wish you the best of luck. And thank you so much for taking an hour of your time to talk to me and give me your story. It's been interesting.
Thank you so much for letting me try to struggle through it and deal with all this fame. I don't know. There's not a lot of fame, but it's definitely an adjustment.
I hope to hear more in the future. So thanks again.
Yes. And hopefully not on the jail roster.
No.
Thank you.
Well, it's Friday and time once again for Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing this morning, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
As always, it's great to have you. Well, it sounds like two big stories this past week. Maybe we start with the biggest. We finally have a police chief for the city who still needs to be formally confirmed, I believe, by city council. But my read of this is we've got something of a compromise candidate here. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, I guess that's one way to look at it. Chacon is a surprise, most notably just because he's an internal hire, right? And it seems like both criminal justice reformers, people at the Austin Justice Coalition, and the Austin Police Association, the union, both didn't want an internal hire, right? Neither of them wanted someone from within the department. For the activist side of things, that's kind of rooted in this belief going back, you know, to November 2019, when revelations that a former assistant chief, you know, regularly used racist language, and management, or Chief Brian Manley at the time, there was a third party investigation looking into this. And really, you know, in response to that, there has been a lot of criticism of the culture at APD, bigotry, sexism, racism, that is, you know, not uncommon among police departments nationwide, but also a retaliatory culture where people were afraid to speak out against this kind of bigoted rhetoric and behavior out of fear of their jobs, right? And so activists did not want an internal hire, someone who has come from that culture, because there's this kind of belief that they would have a harder time dismantling it, right? And kind of truly reforming, reimagining the police department away from those tendencies. And Chief Chacon, he's got more than 20 years experience at APD, so he is very much of that culture. He was an assistant chief at the time that these revelations surfaced in 2019. So he was in a leadership position at the time. So that's a big concern for activists. Another one is a little more technical, but basically there's a provision in state law that prevents the city manager, who is the only person in the city that has authority to hire or fire a public safety chief. But the state law prevents a public safety chief that was hired from within the department from ever being fired. They can only be demoted to a different position, can't actually be fired from the department. And this is seen as one of the factors that led to Brian Manley keeping his job last summer when he fell under, you know, intense criticism for how his officers responded to protesters during the 2020 Black Lives Matter demonstrations, most of them, you know, downtown in front of the APD headquarters. That was just, you know, one of the kind of inciting factors that led to activists and the community at large calling for his firing. So those are two big concerns that activists had about an internal hire. Meanwhile, the police union, the police association, they also wanted an outside perspective, right? From their view, the department is at this really critical juncture, undergoing a really intense attrition rate. More officers are leaving every month than ever before. Morale is really low for a number of reasons. And so they were really hoping for someone from outside of the department to bring a new vision to kind of correct some of these issues. And they've really, you know, gone out of their way to communicate to the public that Chacon was not their pick. Soon after, city manager Kronk announced Chacon as the next chief, pending council confirmation on September 30th, the police association sent out a statement saying explicitly, he's not our pick. We wanted Amira Tingoridis, who is a deputy chief at the Los Angeles Police Department. That was their pick. They really liked her. And then the following day, they released polling, a survey from their members showing that they overwhelmingly wanted Tingoridis as the next chief. So really, you know, right out the gate, They're sending this message to Chacon that you're going to have to work hard to win us over, right? The rank and file union members, you're going to have to really try and win our support. Really is going to put Chacon in a precarious position, because almost by default, moves that would appease the police association are going to upset the reform wing of City Hall political insiders, right? And people within the city who are wanting to push for greater accountability and transparency and things of that nature. So it's been an interesting week to see that all really kind of play out in the media, as Chacon obviously wants to kind of celebrate this milestone in his career, but is immediately coming under fire from activists, from the police association, which is really going to make his job difficult. But I think that's kind of the nature of the job.
Backing up just a little, I want to clarify that Chacon himself was never accused of any kind of racist behavior, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Sorry for the confusion. The former assistant chief is Justin Newsom, who was accused of this behavior. Chacon was not accused or named in those allegations, but he was an assistant chief. So he was among the fifth floor executive leadership at the time that these allegations surfaced and the behavior was occurring. From what we know, he didn't do anything or enough to kind of stop that behavior.
Right. I heard an interview with Chris Harris about that. That was exactly his point. He could have done more to change things and he didn't.
So, right.
Yeah, I totally concur. It's kind of hard to imagine, where does Chacon go from here with the APA being so vocal against him? Clearly, the progressive end of politics here, and certainly some members of city council, and I've already heard from AJC and some other organizations that they're not very happy at this point either. So,
I expect Chacon will face some tough questioning September 30th when council meets and his confirmation is on their agenda. I expect him to be, confirmed. It would be pretty shocking if there were 6 votes to reject his nomination. There may be some people, some council members who vote against. We'll see. It'll largely depend on the responses he gives on Thursday. So some of the questions he'll be asked, but it'll be interesting to watch how that process plays out and what kind of moves he makes, given he's really caught between the reformers and the police association.
Yeah. And those hearings are coming up at the next city council meeting on Thursday, the 30th. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he could face a bit of a grilling there. That'll be interesting to watch.
Right. It's kind of the opportunity for council members to get him on the record, in terms of philosophy, policy, things of that nature. It'll be interesting to watch, and I'll be writing about it for sure.
Well, speaking of APD, there was a public safety committee meeting this past Monday, right?
Right, yeah. And that kind of ties into, of course, how Chacon will handle being chief, right? How officers are held accountable, how the chief interacts with the Office of Police Oversight to achieve transparent accountability of officers who engage in misconduct will be a huge measure of how reformers and the association measure Chacon's performance as chief. And so at the Public Safety Committee meeting September 20th, OPO gave a briefing kind of updating members of that committee on investigations into complaints filed just by regular citizens with the Office of Police Oversight about alleged officer misconduct that occurred during the George Floyd, Mike Ramos protests, mostly during May and June of 2020.
And I'll point out that there were hundreds of them, right?
Right, yeah. More than 1,000 contacts that OPO received during that time period. They kind of narrowed that down to 308 complaints, and then that was further whittled down to 202 were the complaints that were like non-duplicated ones that OPO requested APD investigate. That's how the relationship works here. OPO can receive complaints and recommend that APD's Internal Affairs Division investigate them, but OPO doesn't have any authority to do investigations or order investigations. I can only recommend them. So 202 complaints were referred to APD for investigation. Of those 202, only 27 were investigated. So right there, we have a big problem. Something that Councilmember Greg Kassar on the committee drew attention to, saying that just that number alone, that discrepancy is a problem, right? And you've interviewed Farrah Muskinen, the director of OPO. So your listeners will have heard her say something to the effect of, one of the reasons for creating this new Office of Police Oversight and changing the way people can submit complaints was to have more complaints investigated, not fewer, right? So this discrepancy is a big problem, especially when compared alongside another number, which is the 21 complaints that were filed internally by APD. This could come from, you know, different staff, internal affairs, just a variety of people could see misconduct and, you know, recommend internal affairs investigate those complaints. There was 21 submitted. All 21 of those were investigated, right? So again, this just really highlights the strained relationship, I think is a way to put it, between the department and OPO. When you have so few as a percentage of the OPO complaints being investigated, while 100% of the internal APD complaints were investigated.
And backing up to Chacon, so he's been at the helm since what, April or so? Is that right?
Yeah, March or April as interim.
Right, this past spring. And so a lot of this investigation was taking place under his watch, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of part of the black box of police accountability. We don't really know when investigations are occurring, what is happening in investigations until they are completed. What we do know is that there's been 48 complaints total, right? The 21 internal, 27 external complaints. And we know that at least 23 investigations have been completed, right? And in those investigations, 11 of the complaints were sustained, which means that they were found to be a policy violation of some sort. 12 resulted in exonerations, which, you know, means the Department of Internal Affairs said there wasn't any policy violation here. So, yeah, I mean, it's reasonable to conclude that Chacon was overseeing internal affairs during some of those investigations. It's hard to know for sure, though, because, again, they were coming in last fall and winter when Brian Manley was still chief. So we don't really know for sure how much of the investigative work into these complaints was completed before Brian Manley left.
As far as you know, the policy on use of these beanbag rounds, is anything changed there? I mean, is that still the policy?
APD says they're not going to be used for these crowd control situations like they were during the protest. They'll use other means of crowd control and then use the lead pellet rounds in kind of like SWAT hostage situations, perhaps. More individualized use rather than as a means of crowd control, which should help. But this is another part of the story. APD has been conducting an after-action report. It's unclear when this began, but it's an internal review of the department's response to those protests. And I know that the department has at least completed several drafts of this report. It has not been made public yet. It seems that they are still working on it. And I think the plan is to present it to council in the next few weeks. But at this time, it's kind of unclear what will be in that report. But presumably, there would be stuff about the use of these rounds, whether they should have been used, should they be used differently, and things of that nature.
Did I read in your article where there's some concerns about national security or something withholding these reports?
Yeah, so I submitted a public information request to obtain the report. And when you submit a request to a governmental agency, they can petition the Attorney General of Texas if they don't want to release the records. I mean, they kind of have to prove why. And there's a number of reasons they can evoke in the law that would allow them to withhold the information. And one of them, it contains confidential staffing, tactical information that could if given to the public, could pose a threat to those staffing or tactical plans. Obviously, I don't know what's in the report, so I don't know if that's true, but the city's attorneys argued that if this report was released, it could help terrorists or other criminal actors, is the language that they use in the law, who want to disrupt police staffing or tactical response to mass demonstrations and protest movements. So again, don't know if that's true. That's the reasoning that they've submitted to the Attorney General for why these records should not be released.
Well, and we don't know, I guess. It seems a kind of a convenient excuse, though. I mean, who knows what's going on?
Yeah, that's kind of the way when governments push back against records requests, you know, it kind of sometimes can strain credulity about whether or not their excuse is justified or not. They're acting within the law and they have the right to do that.
And, you know, just backing away a little bit here, the big picture, forgetting about just APD and OPO, and the DA is getting involved in all this, right?
Yeah. So some of the alleged misconduct during the protest is also being investigated as criminal activity, right? I think I counted about 16 officers who are under investigation by the district attorney's office for alleged use of force that would rise to a criminal penalty. Those cases are still under review, but I've learned that they should be presented to a grand jury sometime between October and January when a new grand jury is convened. These jurors, these Travis County residents, will review the evidence and determine if the way that these officers behaved amounts to criminal action. And in that case, the DA could pursue charges against these officers.
Well, lots going on here for sure, and plenty of follow-up required, that's for sure. We'll be looking to you for coverage of all this in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, I'll be back on, and I'm sure we'll be talking about most of this stuff again.
Well, really appreciate your time and all your insights here this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on, Bob.
We are about out of time this program hour, but before we go, we'll leave you with a song that seemed an appropriate ending to the discussion I had with our main guest this evening. It's a catchy little country rock ditty by Brantley Gilbert and Lindsay L. titled What Happens in a Small Town. And don't forget that up next on coop.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel is YouthSpin in its new time slot. On air since 1996, YouthSpin brings varied perspectives of Austin's younger voices through commentaries, interviews, music, and more. So stay safe and stay tuned to Co-op Radio. Have a good evening, everyone.